say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation where the rivers run clean through the forests of green where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with peace.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can listen to this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes climate change is changing the ocean. Ocean scientists find the effects of climate change in the world's ocean. Mass acidification and warming temperatures to sea level rise and sea ice loss. Ira Plato and guests explore how the oceans are changing. And then after that, Scott Horton interviews Gareth Porter. Gareth Porter is an independent historian and journalist for IPS News. He discusses the acceptance of the false Iraqi war narrative. And he explains how the U.S. and Iran are essentially partners in meddling in Iraqi politics. And then, after that, Riz Khan of Al Jazeera English questions the food distribution system. He asks, with more than 1 billion people around the world considered overweight, why are there so many others still starving and struggling to fill their place?
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flato. When you hear the words climate change, chances are you think about its effects on the land, right? You talk about drugs and crops and glaciers. But some scientists say we shouldn't be calling it climate change. We should be calling it ocean change, because the oceans are literally choking, they say, on greenhouse gases. They're becoming more acidic. There are changes in ocean circulation patterns. Fisheries, corals, plankton, shellfish, they are all being affected by the changing water. There's also more water in the oceans than ever before. Sea level is rising as polar ice and glaciers are melting, and even the water itself is expanding as it warms up. So what does that mean for those that live on islands or along the coasts, rising oceans? That's what we'll be talking about today. We're broadcasting from a conference of the National Council for Science and the Environment. Our changing oceans is the theme of the conference, and we'll be talking about our changing oceans this hour. And if you'd like to join the discussion, please step up to the microphone right here in the building, in the auditorium that we're sitting in, or go to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're welcoming your tweets at SciFry, at SCIFRI, or you could phone us, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. John Bruno is marine ecologist and associate professor in the Department of Biology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for covering this topic, Ira.
Steve Neerham is a professor in the Department of Aerospace Engineering Sciences at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's also the Associate Director of the Colorado Center for Aerodynamics Research there. Thanks for being with us today.
It's great to be here, Ira.
Thank you. Margaret Linen is the Director of the Climate Response Fund. She is incoming Executive Director of the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute and Associate Provost of Marine Environmental Initiatives at Florida Atlantic University. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
You're welcome. Steve Gaines is the Dean of the School of Environmental Science and Management at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's also on a panel for a National Research Council series of reports called America's Climate Choices.
Pleasure to be here, Ira.
Thank you. John Bruno, let me begin with you because I was sort of paraphrasing you about the oceans. It's not climate change, it's ocean change. That's your opinion, your view of this.
It is. In fact, most of the heat from greenhouse gases is going directly into the ocean, about 94%, compared to about the other 6% going into the atmosphere and the lands, and it's having just profound changes on ocean ecosystems.
Where would we see that happening most rapidly? Which ocean ecosystems?
I think probably the Arctic and the Antarctic. Yeah, the high poles where it's warming most quickly, but there's certainly profound changes on tropical environments like coral reefs, seagrass beds. It's really global and just amazing to see it.
I was reading some research about what's going on in Antarctica and how we may have these crunching fish, the fish that like to crunch bones, coming back like they've never been there before or haven't been there for tens of millions of years.
That's right. So the Antarctic bentho, so that the seafloor of the Antarctic between 0 and 300 or 400 feet is a really special environment. So there haven't been bone-crushing predators there for tens of millions of years. So there's no big crabs, there's no elasmobranch, sharks and rays. And as a result, the animals there are these big, juicy, squishy animals. They're undefended from predators, and that's all going to change in our lifetimes. There's king crabs already moving in, and sharks and rays will be there definitely by the end of the century. And
is that right?
Yeah, it's not a physical barrier. It's a purely physiological barrier. Those big active predators just can't handle the cold waters of the Antarctic, but it's warming rapidly, and it's going to let them all in.
And we're also seeing changes in the other end of the pole, in the Arctic regions, too, with ice-free regions, changes in fisheries that are going to would be happening up there?
Yeah, and we talk a lot about Arctic sea ice melting, and what you usually hear about that is polar bears are losing habitat and ships are going to be able to go across the top of the Earth, and that'll be great for trade routes. But the really profound ecological impact is an opening of an exchange between the North Pacific and the North Atlantic. There's going to be hundreds or thousands of species moving from the Bering Sea through a new Arctic Sea. It'll be ice-free. There'll be seagrass on the bottom. There'll be marine mammals and birds. Yeah. It'll be like a normal ocean into the North Atlantic. It'll just profoundly change the whole composition of the system.
We're going to actually talk to someone up there this hour. We'll get a little bit more in the perspective from someone who's on the scene. And in the meantime, though, Margaret Linen, one of the big effects of increased CO2 levels is ocean acidification.
That's right, Ira. This change that's happening as a result of the CO2 that we're putting into the atmosphere is not just about climate and temperature. It's also about the chemistry of the ocean. And about a third of the CO2 that we put into the atmosphere winds up in the ocean. And what it does is it dissolves in the ocean, and just like the CO2 that powers your soda pop, it forms an acid. And that acid, and the small increase in the acid, is already affecting shellfish aquaculture off the coast of Oregon and Washington, and it has the potential for affecting corals and a host of other organisms.
In fact, the corals are dying all over the world, aren't they?
Well, the death of corals, or the stress on corals that we see now, is a combination of effects. Mm-hmm. One of the major effects is warming, and so many corals are in shallow water. They're feeling the heat first. It's putting a lot of stress on them. There are also corals that are under assault from pollution, and we're nearing the point that corals in the tropics would be affected by acidification.
Mm-hmm. Steve Gaines, your research is in fisheries management, and I talked about at the beginning ocean levels rising, sea levels are rising. How are fish populations affected by all of this climate change?
Well, surprisingly, about 20% of the protein that people eat comes from the sea. I think most people don't think it's anywhere near that high. And climate change is going to have a big impact on that, because when species move towards the poles, it changes the types of fish you can catch in one place. When warming reduces the productivity of the ocean by making phytoplankton be more nutrient limited in parts of the ocean, it makes the food webs that depend upon that phytoplankton a decrease in abundance. And so there's a potential for fairly dramatic declines and rearrangement of where the fish occur.
You mean the fish want to go where the water is colder, so they move toward the pole?
Sure.
And is that's happening already.
We've seen it already. And so there's because of the fact we keep records on where fish are caught, we're able to reconstruct how they've moved. And in the North Atlantic in particular, there's evidence for a fairly dramatic movement towards the poles for a large number of species of fish already, even in the last couple of decades.
Mm-hmm. And there used to be a natural barrier to them because there used to be more ice, right, at the pole. And certainly in the Arctic region, that ice is gone.
That's correct. There are also other places, though, where there are still barriers. And so there are some places where this movement's not going to be possible. And so then instead of species being able to move, they run into barriers, whether it's either collisions of currents or major areas without habitat that it can potentially drive extinction instead.
Mm-hmm. Steve Nerum, I was talking yesterday here. I was talking to General Walsh, who's involved in the Army Corps of Engineers and very much involved in the shorelines of the Mississippi and other places along here. And he was talking about as ocean levels rise, we don't really have a plan for 50, 100, 200 years from now. But these ocean levels are going to keep rising, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And we don't really have a plan, but we have a lot of great satellite measurements now that are telling us that sea level is going up about an inch a year, a little more than an inch
a year.
An
inch a decade. But that's pretty, for a coastline like, Louisiana and the Gulf, that's a lot, isn't it?
It is a lot. And then there's, we're looking at projections for the future, and there's a lot of people now who are thinking that a meter by 2100 is well within the range of possibility.
What is the range of possibility?
Well, that's the big question. That's where all the research is right now, is what people are looking at. A meter is in that range, but from 80 centimeters up to a meter and a half is probably a good bet.
And could something happen to accelerate that unexpectedly? Could we have more ice melting in Greenland or Antarctica or something?
Well, definitely. It's the components of sea level change are really thermal expansion, which is about a third of what we have right now. Mountain glaciers outside of Greenland and Antarctica, another third. But then it's really the big ice sheets that have the most water locked at them, and we have 6 meters of potential sea level rise in Greenland, 60 meters in Antarctica, and that's where the potential for something that we didn't anticipate could happen sooner than we think.
And John Bruno, is Dr. Doom of the oceans, does this figure into all of what you're talking about?
It absolutely does. We're worried that we're going to start losing coastal habitats like seagrass beds, salt marshes, mangroves, as sea level rise becomes too quick for those habitats to keep up with, coral reefs as well.
Because those mangroves can't move anywhere, can they?
They can move. So they do naturally accrete vertically. Coral reefs, all four of those habitats accrete. In fact, they really depend on sea level rise to build these big habitats that we really use now. But if sea level rise gets too rapid, they just get drowned effectively.
Should there be some planning to how to overcome this, or to recognize that there's nothing that even if we stopped putting CO2 in the atmosphere now, there's going to be a sea level rise for X number of decades, right? Is there any planning that we can do to adapt to that change now? I'll ask any of you. I mean, should there be some sort of planning? Should we be thinking about other kinds of coral that could live in warmer water, or find ways to make sure that the fisheries in the North Pole don't get impact, Steve? Anything that we could be planning on?
Well, I think there is some planning that's going on in terms of coastal infrastructure that I'm aware of. But a lot of them don't know what number to plan for because of the uncertainty in the science. So I think more needs to be invested in studying the problem so we can have better projections of what's going to happen in 100 years or 200 years.
Yeah, and that seems to be the point. We don't know what that number is or what to plan for. Yeah, we can bring all these Dutch scientists in to tell us how to build dikes and things, but we don't know what that number is going to be.
I mean, I know a lot of groups that are planning for 55 inches of sea level rise by 2100 because that's one number that's out there in the literature, but it's got a big uncertainty associated with it.
Mm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. If you want to ask a question in the audience, please step up to the mic. You can also send us a question at scifri@scifri. We're talking about oceans this hour in Washington, and a lot of people are interested, and people just don't seem to know how to. It's a large subject to grasp. It's a big project. Are we able to handle a big project like this, or are we just, is this something just beyond us, beyond our abilities? I mean, our abilities to handle a giant project. We'll ask that question to our audience. 1-800-989-8255. If you'd like to join us, tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We have to go to a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. We'll come back here from Washington. Don't go away. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about how climate change is changing the oceans. My guests are John Bruno, Steve Nirum, Margaret Leinen, and Steve Gaines. And also, we want to talk about the effects of climate change, where they appear to be most obvious, and as we mentioned before, that's in the warming Arctic regions where we see images of polar bears stranded on sea ice. But more than polar bears are being affected by the changing sea ice. And joining us by phone from Anchorage to talk more about it is Hayo Eiken. He is professor of Geophysical Institute and the Department of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. And he served on the advisory panel for this conference. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Eiken.
Thanks for having me.
When we talked with you way back in 2007, when we were in Alaska, you were up there in the Arctic. What we didn't know then in 2007 would be that year turned out to be the worst on record for the sea ice.
Yeah, that's right. When we talked, that was in June, I believe, we were just starting to see what turned out to be a record ice retreat to a record minimum, at least since 1979. 2007, we had about a quarter less sea ice at the end of the summer than we had at the during the previous record minimum, which was set in 2005. So 2007 was really a very, very remarkable year and something that's been quite unusual.
Is it too short a time to talk about changes since then, since 2007?
No, I would say, I mean, what we've seen is that since in 2008, in particular in the North American Arctic, we even had less sea ice than in 2007. And since the total summer ice extent has been hovering around values comparable to 2007, a bit more, but it's clear based on what we know now about changes in the ice thickness and the composition of the Arctic ice pack, that definitely things are quite different now than even from, say, 5 years ago.
Well, and still, do you think that trend is going to continue, that the sea ice will be less and less? Can that happen?
Yeah, I mean, you might have discussed this earlier already, but of course, if you look at climate model projections, it's clear that they show an overall trend of decreasing summer ice extent. The question, of course, is, and that's something that I think a lot of people are looking at very carefully now, is that both the models as well as what we're seeing now suggest that things are going to be much more variable. We've lost a lot of the big, thick, old ice, which provides a bit of a sort of, it's almost like a flywheel in the sense that even if you have an anomalous summer, there's enough inertia in the system if you have a lot of this thick ice to just keep things on an even level. Now that we have less of that thick ice, it's clear that ice conditions are going to be more variable, in particular at the regional level, and that the predictability of the ice cover, at least on those timescales of a few years, may be reduced. But overall, it seems to be clear that we're looking at what is now part of this decline of the Arctic ice. Mm-hmm.
I know that you have started on a new project since we last spoke. You're looking at what you can learn about the ice from native people. Can you tell us about that?
Well, working in Alaska, of course, we see a lot of these changes firsthand, and as we're seeing more and more activity in the Arctic also, in part not so much a result of the changing ice cover, but just the large-scale global economic development. Of course, the question is: well, how do these changes that everybody is well aware of at the pan-Arctic level, how do they actually play out at the regional level? Mm-hmm. And what you find is, if you talk to Alaska Native or other ice experts around the Circumarctic, is that people in a lot of these coastal communities already have moved on. They're not discussing anymore about, you know, are there changes, how large are they, but they've really started to change the way they live with the ice cover. We've been working with people in the community of Barrow and communities on St. Lawrence Island and the Bering Sea, And you really do see that these people have changed the way they hunt among sea ice, the way they travel over the ice cover, and a lot of that deep knowledge and insight that these local experts have can also provide us, at least at the local and the regional level, with interesting insights into, you know, how is it that we can better predict ice, in particular in order to ensure safe operations and overall environmental security, if you will.
Well, Dr. Eichen, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. And good luck. We'll check back up there with you as we follow the seasons. Hayo Eichen is a professor at the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Still with me here at the Oceans Conference in Washington are John Bruno, Steve Neerham, Margaret Leinen, and Steve Gaines. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the audience for a question here.
Hi, Cameron from the Olympic Peninsula on the other Washington. And I'm just wondering, what are all these changes, like the acidification, the migration, the sea level rise, what effects are they going to have on aquaculture and, like, maybe even the price of food?
Mm-hmm. Well, ocean acidification is already having a big impact on aquaculture. And right now, NOAA is having to predict events when the low CO or the high CO2 water will come up on shore, and aquaculture farms in Oregon and Washington are having to pull the larvae out of the water because the acidity of the water is too high for them to survive. So that's something that the shellfish aquaculture people are very concerned about. The Pacific Fishery Council is concerned about, NOAA, and they expect to see it increase.
Good question. Yes, sir.
Yes, Daryl Carnes, Rivers Institute, Biology Department, Hanover College. As an educator, I'm concerned about creating a generation of eco-fatalists, and I'm wondering what message of hope and change the panel would have for students interested in the study of the natural world.
Well, I ask, can we tackle this project? And I think we absolutely can. I mean, look at the cities we built. We've gone to the moon. We created the iPad. I mean, there's no question we can tackle this problem. I mean, we already know what the solutions are. We just have to, do it. And I think the thing I'd say to students is there's still a lot of wonderful, amazing wild places in the ocean. I mean, there's reefs we go to in the Bahamas that are just phenomenal with lots of sharks and healthy corals. So, I mean, it's a system that's definitely still savable and worth saving. Well,
if you have dozens and dozens of congresspeople who don't believe in global warming, how are you going to handle this problem and get something done there?
We're going to take them scuba diving and let them see it firsthand.
Seriously?
I'd love to, sure.
Take them to Greenland to see the melting ice.
But is it not a question of science? The science is there. Or is it a question of perception? Is it a question of dogmatic beliefs and things that nothing you can show people will change their minds if they want to not believe it?
Yeah, I think once if you can talk about the science, yes, then it's an easy argument. You can show them the data, and they'll believe it. But when it becomes a political question, then it becomes more emotional, and it's very hard to make progress there.
Hangman, hangman, slack your line. Slack it just a while, for I think I see my papa coming, traveling many a mile. Traveling many a mile. Papa, Papa, has you brought gold for to pay this hangman's fee? Or did you come to see me swinging high from this hangman's tree, high from this hangman's tree? Da-da-da-da-da-da, I brought no gold for to pay this hangman's fee, but I come to see you swinging, swinging high from this hangman's tree, high from this hangman's tree. Hangman, hangman, slack your line. Slack it just a while, for I think I see my mama coming, traveling many a mile, mama, 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 have you brought gold for to pay this hangman's fee, or did you come to see me swinging high from this hangman's tree, high from this hangman's tree? Daughter, 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 I brought no gold for to pay this hangman's fee, but I come to see you swinging, swinging high from this hangman's tree, high from this hangman's tree. Hangman, hangman, slack your line, slack it just a while, for I think I see my lover coming, traveling many a mile, traveling many a mile. Sweetheart, 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 did you bring gold for to pay this hangman's fee, or did you come to see me swinging high from this hangman's tree, high from this hangman's tree? Darling, 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 I brought that gold for to pay that hangman's fee, 'cause I don't want to see you swinging, swinging high from this hangman's tree, high from this hangman's tree.
And now for something completely different.